As Craig said, I changed the title a little bit to be more consistent with the topics that are being discussed here. So I think there'll be at least some points of contact both with Kurt's talk and perhaps Craig's talk tomorrow. So again, here's the title. So I'm going to be speaking mainly as an example. Is that in focus? As an example, I'll mainly be speaking about so-called multi-matrix models. So the idea is one has some ensemble whose elements are L-tuples of matrices. You may as well think of them for the present purposes as Hermitian matrices, although there are other variants that will work just as well, as long as they're as long as they're diagonalizable unitarily with spectrum in along some curve. It need not be the real line. But let's say they're Hermitian matrices, and we put a measure. Well, it's not one measure. It's a whole class of measures which are defined like this. So this will be the partition function, and we're going to integrate in the usual way over the Hermitian matrices, treating the real and complex parts of the entries as the parameters, the variables, with a measure that is of this form. So let's just look at this. It involves the exponential of the trace of minus the sum over all of the matrices of some function. You can think, to be concrete, of these VIs as being polynomials. The Gaussian case would be where it's a quadratic polynomial. In general, it just has to be chosen to be convergent, and there could be other polynomials, in fact, other functions where these are convergent integrals, either on the real line or on some segment of it. These would be the uncoupled part, where the matrices were independent of each other, and the coupling is as in a chain. So one has a chain in which there's just nearest neighbors that are coupled. So this is what prevents it from being simply a product measure over the individual matrix ensembles consisting of one at a time. That's the particular model. So those are modeled in a chain, and notice that it's all conjugation invariant. So if we conjugate under the unitary group, we can just integrate out a trivial normalization factor that's absorbed in the constant that I put there. And what we obtain, we're starting out in principle by an L times N squared dimensional integral, and it reduces to an L times N dimensional integral over the N eigenvalues. So from here on, one only looks at measures over spaces of eigenvalues on the real line. So these will be, if the matrices are N by N, this will form an N-component vector, and they're L of them. And so we have an NL dimensional space. It's not yet a normalized probability, but let's call this the probability density. We have to put in, of course, we have to divide by Zn to get a normalized probability. So this reduction is not an obvious one. I want to point out it goes back to a result of Harish Chandra and was rediscovered by Itzigsen and Zuber. The reason why it's not obvious is because these matrices don't commute. So it's not evident that we should, just by factoring out a conjugation, it's not evident that we should be able to project to integrals only over the eigenvalues, since we cannot simultaneously diagonalize these matrices. Nevertheless, it works. But notice what comes in here. Besides the obvious factor, which would be the factor coming from diagonal matrices with eigenvalues XIA, where A runs from 1 to N and I runs from 1 to L, we also have the usual Jacobian factor, which is a van der Mond determinant. This is well known in one matrix model. Here we have one, but notice that there's only one at each endpoint. So the endpoints of this chain play a special role. There's a van der Mond factor for the first endpoint and van der Mond factor for the last endpoint, and no intermediate factors. Okay, so that's the starting point. I don't know, I wear these glasses, they're for reading, so I'll put them down. So what do we calculate? Well, typical things that we calculate are expectation values to begin with. Some people call linear statistics, expectation values of functions which themselves are, to begin with, if they are invariant under UN, to the power L, that is under individual conjugation of all of the matrices, then these will evidently project to integrals over the eigenvalues only. However, just a caveat, there are some functions which are only invariant under global conjugation and nevertheless project to n-dimensional integrals. For instance, we could form something like the trace of the product of the m1 to some power and m2 to some power, and that too, for somewhat mysterious reasons related to the calculation behind this, allows us to go to the reduced space. So we're only going to look at quantities that are well defined on the reduced space, on the space of eigenvalues. And so so expectation values will be defined this way. But I want to point out that the Itzigsohn-Zuber-Harishchandra identity does not allow us to reduce, of course, arbitrary such expectation values unless they are individually, they're invariant under individual conjugations by different unitary transformations and some others. So the most important to begin with would be obviously the case of the characteristic polynomial. So let's take the characteristic polynomial of the first matrix, M1, and of the and the last one, ML, and call its expectation value pi n sigma n. So these are monic by definition. The leading term has coefficient 1. They're monic polynomials of degrees n and n. I'm writing them as functions of different variables. Because of the fact that, in fact, this is a very nice way, you don't need matrix models to do this, but a very nice way to define a sequence of what are called bi-orthogonal polynomials, of which you can define them exactly this way. So let's look now at the properties. If you take, now let n, the size of the matrix, vary over all the integers, and so a and b are these integers, then there's a bi-orthogonal property which says that if we integrate over both variables, x and y, with a certain weight, which I'm calling GL1, you'll see why in a minute, then for different values of the degrees, these are orthogonal, with some normalization factor HA. And the factor that determines the measure is some partial integration of the factor that enters the probability. We have a sum over all of the intermediate terms in the potential and the XIs, but notice that we're integrating out all but the first and last X1 and XL, so we're integrating over all the intermediate variables in the probability, and that's what. And we're not including the van der Monde factor in the integral. So these are just the factorized ones plus the coupling. So that is a fairly easily proved property. Now one goes a little further, and first of all, let's normalize. Let's take these two polynomials pi and sigma and normalize them so they become bi-orthogonal functions. So divide by the normalization factor and multiply by the square root of the exponential term which entered into the measure for one factor and into the other factor. This is supposed to be a 1 here and an L there. And let's define, so these are indices, I'll explain these in a moment. You think of it as starting at one end. In fact, you could make a little bit contact with Kurt's talk this morning. If you think of a sequence of random matrices, you could think of these as the elements in the sequence, the first and the last, although I will not be talking about random processes. So the first and the last play a special role. But as we go from one point in this chain to the next, for the psis, we're starting at the bottom on the left-hand side, and with the phis, we're starting on the right with the L's. And then we'll have a sequence of integral operators, which will be used to define some intermediate functions, which will all enter into the definition of the correlation functions, which I'll give in a moment, or into the computation of them. So what we do is we have an integral operator, a sequence of integral operators, which I'm calling GKJ, such that the integral operator from 1 to K takes you from the psi 1 to the psi K, and this is for all values, K going from 1 down to L, and its dual, just integrating with respect to the opposite variable, takes you up. This takes you up, and this one takes you down. So this is going from right-left, and this is going from left-right. And that gives us a whole sequence of functions which, by construction, are bi-orthogonal. They all satisfy an orthogonality relation to this, but I have to tell you what these G's are. So one has these bi-orthogonal functions, of which only the two endpoints are polynomials multiplied by exponentials. They belong to some function space. I'm not being specific about what it is, but the intermediate ones are not polynomials. But they're all bi-orthogonal in the sense that they're dual to each other with a normalized bearing. Now I have to tell you what these integral operators are. Well, in this example, I'm going to go to a more general case in a moment. In this example, two indices, when they're neighboring, j, j plus 1, is just a little piece of the measure on the eigenvalue space, namely the one which connects the jth point to the j plus 1th point and 1 half of the exponential term. That's what the neighboring ones, you think of that as the kernel of an integral operator, and then you define the general ones by composition. You take the ones which take from j to j1 and so on step by step until you reach the point k, and that is the definition of the integral operator gkj. So now I've defined everything on the transparency. Let's get to the next line, because this is crucial, and this is where I hope to make contact with what Kurt said this morning. Namely, we define what will be also an integral kernel by taking sums of products of these functions at any level. Let's say ij. You have psi I here, the first sequence, phi j there, evaluated, well, I can call the variables xi and xj, and summed over all values. These are, remember that these are, to begin with, the 1 and the L were polynomials multiplied by exponentials minus 1 half v, but the intermediate ones are not. So we sum over the same indices, whatever they are, and that defines a certain integral kernel. And we'll define an integral operator. Here I'm using the same notation for the kernel as for the operator, but I want to go back a moment. This gkj is defined in such a way that it's by composition when k is greater than j, but by definition it's zero if j is greater than k. So you can think of that as forming a lower triangular matrix of integral operators of which these are the kernels. These k's also form some integral operators. We take the difference between the two. So we have a full matrix of integral operators with the kernels defined here, minus the lower triangular one. This defines a quantity k tilde, which is an L by L matrix of integral operators, Fredholm integral operators. Now, why did I do all that? Well, I'm anticipating the next fact, which is a well-known one. It goes back, I believe, to Mehta and Enar in 1998, namely that the correlation function, which tells us the probability of finding in an infinitesimal neighborhood of the points x11 up to x1k for the first matrix, k of its eigenvalues, and the same thing for the next matrix, so on, up till the lth matrix. This is the probability of finding these eigenvalues within some infinitesimal neighborhood of those points up to a combinatorial factor, which is just a lot of factorials in the denominator. It's the integral over the original measure on the eigenvalue space, where we integrate out all the remaining variables, those which do not appear. So we take the product over all those x's starting from k1 plus 1 and similarly starting from kl plus 1, integrate them out, and what's left over with this combinatorial factor is the probability of finding eigenvalues at those points or in infinitesimal neighborhoods. And then the result, I believe Einar Mehta first proved this, is that if we take now a matrix which consists of blocks which are labeled by the ij's, and in which we insert values of the eigenvalues into these kernels at the appropriate points. So this is a block in which ij varies from 1 to L, and the indices alpha I, alpha j vary from 1 to ki and 1 to kj. We form a determinant from that, and that's equal to this correlation function. So this is, I didn't write an intermediate formula which indicates this, but this is a particular case of the type of determinantal correlation function that Kurt wrote this morning. So these have been named determinantal ensembles rather appropriately because of this property. Now I'd like to mention two other properties, probabilistic properties, that one can calculate for such ensembles before going to the more general case. One is the so-called gap probabilities, which are closely related to the spacing distribution. So that just means the probability of having no eigenvalues of the first matrix in some interval or some union of intervals or some measurable subspace of the real line, and similarly none for the second matrix and so on. So one has a sequence, I1, et cetera, IL, of unions of intervals, and we can attach a weight, so they don't have to be just intervals, they can be weighted by some real number. And the weighted unions are denoted that way, and we can denote by chi 1 up to chi L the corresponding characteristic functions. Then we'll think of these, the characteristic function, as an operator on the space of functions, on the product of these spaces, by multiplication. So we can take the direct sum of all of these characteristic functions, and we'll think of that as a multiplication operator on the product space. And then it's a fact that the probability of having no eigenvalues in the product of these intervals is given also by determinant, but it's not finite dimensional, at least it's not here expressed finite dimensionally. It's a Fredholm determinant. One takes the integral operator, matrix integral operator that I wrote down before, with the kernels I indicated before. This really should be tilde. And composes it with this joint characteristic function or direct sum of characteristic functions, and evaluates the Fredholm determinant as a matrix Fredholm determinant, and that turns out to equal the probability of no eigenvalues in that region. So that's a gap probability. By taking ratios and derivatives of this, one gets the spacing distributions, just as in one matrix models. Finally, there's something called Janosch identities, which I don't know how well it's known, but have existed for some time, and it's a fairly natural thing. All that it really means is a conditional or normalized probability of finding exactly K1 eigenvalues in an infinitesimal neighborhood of the specified points X1 up to XK1 within the given intervals I1, etc., and all the rest elsewhere. Normalized so that the overall normalization factor is not 1, but the previous quantity, namely the gap probability. So that gives a sort of conditional probability. It looks a lot like the correlation functions themselves, but in the difference is puzzling. The difference, it was puzzling to me when I first saw this, but is that there's no condition in general that the remaining eigenvalues should all be in the exterior of these intervals, whereas here that is part of the conditions. So this quantity, it turns out, and this is turns out this is in a finite dimensional setting, this fact that I'm now going to quote, namely that this Janoschy density or Janoschy correlator is given by also a determinantal formula, but where the integral operator involved is not the original 1k, but it's resolvent, the resolvent operator. This fact in a finite dimensional setting is given as an exercise in a book that I've forgotten the title of, so it's something that's been known for some time. I was amazed to see that such a fact, which seems rather sophisticated and specialized, can be given as an exercise for students in the textbook, but it isn't exactly this, but it amounts to this in an infinite dimensional setting. Anyway, the statement is you look at the Fredholm resolvent of the operator composed with a characteristic function, which is defined this way. It's 1 minus k composed with chi inverse times k composed with chi, and so that's the Fredholm resolvent. And the only statement is that this Janoschy density is given by such a Fredholm resolvent. Now, for the rest of the talk, of which I have 10 minutes, I'm going to first of all put this in a somewhat more general setting of multi-level determinantal ensembles, not necessarily random matrices, which actually includes the Preehofer-Spohn random growth or polynuclear growth models and many other multi-level determinantal ensembles where the correlators are given by determinants of such matrices, and state and prove a theorem which is due to Alexander Soshnikov, which tells us how we can compute this quantity. You need to know how to compute the resolvent in order to calculate these densities. And it turns out that there's a beautiful, simple characterization of that resolvent, which Soshnikov and Borodin first found for the one-matrix models and then generalized to multi Sosnikov generalized to multi-matrix models, and the version I'm going to give will be applicable to multi-level determinantal ensembles and actually generalizes his result in a very obvious way as well. So now I'm going to the more general setting, and that's why there's a new title, but it's really a continuation and some repetition, but you'll recognize the elements that we had previously. So the title here is Janosch densities. Well, bi-orthogonal polynomials we've already seen. It's going to be more generally bi-orthogonal functions, spacing distributions, and Fredholm determinants. So we're in this, now you can abstract from the previous example. We'll be in a set of measure spaces on, you could, this was the real line, but this could be something more general with some measure on it. There will be some Hilbert spaces. This is a requirement that is not necessary. We could allow complex measures. We could allow, in fact, we could get away from the L2 requirement, but I'd like to keep it simple. So I'll just say we're looking at L2 functions defined with respect to these measures. And we'll assume that we start out with some arbitrary bases, FA and HA. These are n-dimensional spaces of some n-dimensional subspaces, H1 of one of these Hilbert spaces, and HM, another one of these Hilbert spaces. And we'll assume that we have a sequence of integral operators. You can recognize the notation is the same of what this generalizes. Integral operators, which takes us from one point, one such space to the next. And so this will be the notation, the kernel of the operator for each neighboring point will be denoted this way. This is the thing which in the multi-matrix model was the exponential of the xj plus 1 minus 1 half v1 plus vj. So that abstracts from that. One has the transpose operators and one has the composites, just like in the multi-matrix model. And one starts to consider a sequence of spaces, which are the images. I'm not going to dwell on the domains of definition, but one can define these. Really, basically, we're dealing with finite dimensional spaces. We don't need infinite spaces. They're always finite dimensional subspaces. And we define a matrix, which appeared already in Kurt's talk, the matrix which essentially is the dualization. We'll take the top-level basis, HB, bring it down with the dual of this composite operator, and pair it with fxi with the given measure and integrate, which is equivalent, of course, to lifting fi using the original operator and pairing it. And the assumption is that this matrix, which is just an L by L matrix, is invertible. What this amounts to, if these guys were just polynomials, we'd be talking about something like Gram-Schmidt orthogonalization. But we're not assuming that there's any ordering by degree or triangular property, so we cannot assume that there is a unique upper-lower factorization, but such a matrix always admits a PLU decomposition where U is upper, L is lower, and P is a permutation matrix. So if it's a sequence, you can always set the permutation matrix equal to 1 and have a lower-upper triangular, and then you would be dualizing. Well, you're still dualizing, but you have to arbitrarily include P in one of the two factors. So our sequence of functions are now obtained just by dualizing. This will automatically give us a pair which are mutually dual with respect to integration. And again, we can just deduce that the lowered and raised sequence of functions are also mutually in duality. So this abstracts the relation that we had previously. And I recall that the special case we were looking at was where the gammas were the real line, or intervals on the real line, and the functions FA, HA were essentially monomials with some exponential factor, and G's were just given by these factors. Okay, so now we have a determinantal form for the probability, and this was exactly what Kurt quoted this morning, except it wasn't, well, it's for specific sets of functions. Psi and phi can be as general as we've looked at. That tells me I have 5 minutes left. I'm a self-disciplined speaker. 7? Oh, good. okay, so let's see. Except now I'm reversing orders. Now, again, we introduce the kernels, as before, by summation. And the quantity that I called K tilde here is K check by taking differences. And we think of these, again, as defining some integral operators or a matrix of integral operators on the product spaces. And again, one can express the probability density as a determinant of this Kij factor. I should mention, which I didn't, but it's pertinent to the details, that the diagonal elements of this matrix are just the projection operators onto the first onto the subspace in question, the first n orthogonal functions, or bi-orthogonal functions. The others are not. And one has, again, that the correlation functions are given by similar determinantal relations as in the multi-matrix model. And the Yanoshi densities, everything is essentially the same. I think I'm probably not going to get to the proof of this result, but at least I'll be able to announce it, and that's the important thing. For the proof, it's published, and I'll give you the reference. But for the Yanoshi densities, we define, we have this resolvent operator obtained by composing K with the, again, with some characteristic function, and the statement is just an abstraction of what I said previously, namely the density, the probability of finding these points within the locations indicated within some measurable subsets of the original measure spaces is given by a determinant in terms of this resolvent. So I'm just repeating, and the normalization factor again is what was the gap probability for the multi-matrix case. I'm just repeating this. I'm going to state the theorem by Soshnikov, and I think I won't have time to give a simplified proof. He gave a proof, but it was a 20-page proof, which was rather complicated, and I found a very simple one in a couple of pages, and that's what I was going to communicate to you, but it doesn't matter. I'll just state the results, and if you're interested, you can look it up in International Mathematics Research Notices. So the statement is this. I think I went by too quickly. I left out some definitions. I'm familiar with it, and you're not, so let me go back. The statement is the following. You saw the previous transparency equated the resolvent to something known. It's all within this transparency. So the resolvent is given by another integral operator of the same type as K. It also has this kind of a sum over product decomposition. So it looks like a factorizable or decomposable integral operator. However, what enters here are not the original bi-orthogonal sequences of functions which we defined, but exactly what we would have obtained if instead of bi-orthogonalizing on the original support of our measure, we did it on the complement of the region that we're interested in. So all you do is, again, introduce new bi-orthogonal functions in the same way, or dual sequences of functions, define your integral operator in the same way, and the magic is that the result is the resolvent operator for the previous case, supported on the integral. So I'll repeat, when doing the dualization, you simply replace the original domain or the original support by multiplication by a characteristic function on the complement of the domain that you're interested in. And that gives you some new sequence of bi-orthogonalized functions, and the same formulas define an integral operator which coincide with the resolvent. And, the proof, since I don't have time to say it, I can only indicate that the method of proof that you can find in the reference that I'll give you is based on telescopic sums. Basically, you just write down the definition of the resolvent, which written out in details. Oh, I should mention, there's a generalization of this theorem. One need not necessarily simply take a characteristic function for subintervals. One can simply take the measure and replace it by some multiplicative factor which changes the measure to something else, and then instead of looking at the complement, you just choose 1 minus that multiplicative factor, and the same theorem applies. It's obvious if you think about it why it should work, because after all, how do we define a Riemann or a Lebesgue integral? It's by taking intervals and summing over intervals and taking limits. So in the end, a weighted sum of intervals, as long as your limits are okay, is the same as just changing the measure. So in fact, one can take a pair of measures and look at this as simply a relation between the expectation values and the correlation functions correspond to this pair of measures. But never mind. So wj here just means multiplying by some factor which modifies the measure. If you like, for the original case, it's simply 1 minus the characteristic function. And that picks up the complement of the interval. So this is the relation that's involved, which tells us that k tilde is the resolvent of k. And this actually consists, if you look at the definition, of a relation between four different kinds of quantities, k, k tilde, g, g tilde, and this identity reduces, in fact, to the fact that some of these terms, this in particular, vanishes, and others cancel amongst themselves, and it's a very short proof, but I won't have time to present it, or there won't be time for questions, so I'll just put the transparency with some references on. So this gives some of the background. Maybe more the background than is necessary. The article where this proof is given, this is the reference, International Math Research Notice, it appeared a month or two ago. The background work by Soshnikov is, and Borodin is here and here. And there are other, I mean, the one matrix case and many results of this nature can be found in a very nice article by Craig Tracy and Harold Widom. So this generalizes in some sense. Results there. The examples of these polynuclear growth models are in the papers by Kurt and Prehofer and Spohn, and probably those are the original paper by Einar and Mehta is here. So thank you very much.